Okay. I was just saying that we are going to work with linking and segmentation. That gets us caught up. Okay. Basically, what we want to do and we're going to find out is that lines, well, we don't have any lines yet. All you've done is you've figured out how to compute gradients effectively. We haven't told you how to turn that into representations like equations of lines or things like that. Hopefully we'll get to that at the end of today's lecture. And segmentation, the idea is what you want to do is identify areas or regions that have similar characteristics. For example, this is a NASA thing, and you can you never know why NASA might want to do something particularly, but they, for some reason, have identified this red as being of interest. And I think that red has to do with, like, stuff that's ejected from a volcano on a moon of Jupiter. Okay, admittedly, most of you aren't interested in that. But the thing is, finding regions with that color. And it's actually going to be more sophisticated than that. In this case, it's going to be find regions with this saturated color. Okay, and this is going to be a slightly unusual example. I didn't really point it out the last time. We're working in HSI space. It turns out most of the time, most people really do their image processing in RGB space. HSI processing is a little unusual. Okay, so the original, this is what NASA was interested in, these regions of red, and we've got a red, it is not red, green, blue, it's U, saturation, and intensity. And in the U, remember, you get the big gap going from 0 to 1 around red, because remember, red is where we have our origin. Okay? We've got the saturation. The whites indicate highly saturated colors. It doesn't necessarily mean that they're dark, although it sort of looks that way here. Okay, but it means that they're all red, no white whatsoever, no other colors. It's pure red. Okay, and now, let's see. The first thing that's done in this example is you threshold the saturation. And as I recall, this is a pretty low number. I was looking for it right here. I think they used something like 0.1 to threshold it. Okay, so basically anything above that, whatever it was, is a 1, indicates a highly saturated region. All the low stuff is not saturated. And this one gets a little fancier because what they're going to do is take the U and multiply it by the saturated or the thresholded or binary. Okay, saturation. So you see what you're really doing is multiplying U times saturation. I mean, would you have ever thought of doing anything like that? Unlikely, although you never know. When you multiply this times this, you get something like this. And what this is this is basically saturated reds. Okay? In our case, we might be interested in saturated yellow. Or maybe if we were looking for red traffic lights, we might be interested in finding saturated reds. But this is a fairly complicated thing. This is the histogram now of this product of the two. And remember, this is binary, but that's actually gray. So when you multiply it by it, it still is gray. You can't see it very well, but there is variation in the gray here. And if you look at it in your book, you can see a couple different gray bands. But if you look at the histogram, everything is dark. And all you have left is this right here. Now, standard practice, when you have an image with a computer, it better come back upright. Okay, standard practice, and one of the first ways you can segment is just to threshold an image. Because what do you end up with? Zeros and ones. This isn't zeros and ones. This is a, it's got a complete grayscale. But notice, everything's down here, and there's a little amount of white up here. The standard approach that you would typically do, and we'll talk more about this, is you pick some threshold value in the middle, and lo and behold, we got rid of all the gray, and it should have, but it didn't do a great job of getting rid of some of these smaller pieces. Okay, in general, that's what you want to do. You want to find a threshold that will give you just the object of interest and nothing else. Andy. And what you'd really, really want to do is probably not use 0 to 1. You might want to change, you might want to rotate your space, or what you might want to do is go 0 to 360, keep going around to 720. Yes. That's why I said this is a very rare example that you're doing HSI image processing. Most people do it in RGB. First of all, it's more intuitive. And second of all, you have to have... here, part of it is you're not just looking for red. You're looking for saturated red. This would not find pink, for example. You know, maybe it's because there's a lot of ice. And they don't want to find anything that's covered over by ice. Ice would add a certain amount of white. So this is an unusual example. I don't know why NASA did it, but it is an example of finding a saturated red. Now, I can't think of why we'd want to find a saturated red for Dexter. But this is the result, and you see, it really did identify the so-called saturated red. And we'll talk more about what do you do with this. Because if you're a biomedical engineer, and that was a picture of like a blood vessel, you might want to know its area, its cross-sectional area or something. If you're an astronomer and that indicated the outline of a volcano, you might want to know how big the mouth is. Our cases are very different with mobile robots. We might be more interested in just how far away we are from something, or if we see one line, is there another one near it? We'll talk about those kind of things. Now, I talked about this actually a little bit the last time. How you might identify similar colors, okay? But this is also now, we're using this big new word, segmentation, 4 syllables. Ought to be worth a lot on your resume, okay? But the general one is that you produce a sphere around the color. And if you have a color, say maybe a vector A, you know, this is your RGB space. And what we might have done, I don't know, we might have gone out and classified grass. We might go out and classify asphalt or things like that. And there would be a region in our color space. Now, there's a couple different ways. And it basically comes down to how the stuff is distributed in color space. And you may have to experimentally measure it to find out. The first is, you just put a sphere, you take all of these, you compute the average, the midpoint. For those of you who have taken 484, that looks like a cluster center. That's effectively what you're doing. Okay? But we'll compute an average for these. We've got a sphere around it, and basically we'll use the old-fashioned Euclidean distance measure. Now, as someone pointed out the last time, we might not want to do this particular calculation because of square roots and squares and stuff, but mathematically it's elegant and it's accurate because this is a distance called the Euclidean distance in RGB space. Okay? Now, that's a way of segmentation. Basically, you could say everything that fits into that sphere gets assigned a color. Everything that doesn't fit into that sphere gets assigned maybe gray. And you end up with a two-color image. Now, we don't like to do that because it's computationally intensive. However, this is even more computationally intensive, and we do like to do it. This is an ellipse. And it turns out, if you're going to go out and measure colors, they don't always fall within a sphere. You may have more variation along one axis than another. If you're looking at grass, there may be very little variation in G, lots of variation in blue. Things change. So technically, instead of doing an average, you know, you do a lot of RGBs, you just average them and come up with an average center. Okay? What you might instead do with that set of data is there's a variety of programs out there that will compute the variance matrix, the covariance matrix. So, we can compute the relationship between red and green, and between green and blue. And in effect, we use a different distance measurement where what we've done, and this is really right here, if we were going to do it as a vector, I call this thing, I guess just, let's just call it color average. Now, I don't like C. What's another symbol for color? Okay, Q. I've never seen it used for color, but that's fine. Okay, but the whole idea is here. What you're doing is, if you've got your color vector, and these are vectors, and we are doing this for the plane, that's simply this formula expressed as a vector. That's all. And as you go on and read more literature and stuff, everything is written as vectors. But when you have data that you don't know how well it's behaved or something, what we usually actually do, and this is a much better distance classifier, is we put the covariance matrix. And that gives us the ellipse. Now, to be honest, all of these are great mathematically, but you have to do things real time, fast. Cubes are what we usually use. And they don't always work exactly the same. You'll see subtle differences between them. But cubes or rectangular. solids are what we usually use. Now, for a homework or something, yeah, it's fine if you compute all of the very, very detailed color distances. That's fine. But you don't need to. Okay. Segmentation, this is basically the same image in RGB space. Except this might be more along the lines of how you would do it. Okay? Basically, you come in here and you draw a box and you say, I'm interested in everything that's that color. You've got a whole lot of pixels in here in that side, that rectangle. Each of them has an RGB value. You compute the average RGB for everything inside that box. Okay? And what you can do then is you can come up with an average and what they actually did in this example is they computed the standard deviation of the red, the standard deviation of the green, and the standard deviation of the blue. And basically, let's write in this side to even things out. And this is a way of approaching it. And it turns out they used a cube. There's your average in there. And they picked 1.25 sigma, where sigma is your standard deviation. So this is how you might design a system and say, okay, I've taken the average, I'm interested in all colors that are within 1.25 sigma of the variance of these measurements in color space, not in physical space, in color space. And if you do that, and you just have this simple cube, you only compute the averages once, and you do the same thresholding, if it's in it, it's a 1, white. If it's outside, it's a 0, 1. Now, is that necessarily better or worse than this? Now, I admit, that's smaller. And it may not have the detail, but think about it. The previous one required everything in the image be converted from RGB to HSI. You did calculations in HSI. You had to do the you didn't do averaging, but you did thresholding and all kinds of things. Now, see, this is more finer detail here. And it's not quite the same, but a lot less work. Okay. Now, here's where things start to get interesting. What's a color edge? Okay. This is red, green, and blue. Now, think about it. All the edges are aligned. Red, green, and blue. There is an equal amount of red, green, and blue when I add them, basically looks like I'm going to get a black and a white. Right? From the viewpoint of a color space or a color image, where is the edge in this image? Everyone look and say right there. That's the only edge you see. Now how about if we do this? Here's a red, here's a green, and here's a blue image. we combine them, and because this is rotated, it changes the color balance. Where they're balanced, you have black and gray, but in the other two regions, we have blue and yellow. Where are the color edges? Well, obviously, when I look at this, I see an edge there, but I see an edge there as well. So the question, and this is still a good topic of research, what is a color edge? Now, there are many ways that you can do it. And I don't know how much I want to talk about this. Basically, it comes into multidimensional vector calculus. Okay? It's not as bad as it sounds. But this is probably one of the better techniques that could handle this. And it's moderately complicated. You come up with edge vectors. And these are unit vectors, so that's in the r direction, and we compute, actually, that's in the, these are the RGB unit vectors. And at each point, we compute how the, in the original image, the derivative of r with respect to x. That can be done with a Sobel. That can be done with a Roberts. It can be done with any edge operator you've got. And you do it for all the colors. So you see, that's sort of a vector of the derivative. And you can do the same thing in the y direction. And don't worry, these are all on the scant notes. And now, this is where it gets a little mysterious. And I'm not going to get too complicated here, but we come up with a set of second derivatives. Which are based on those vectors. Okay, and I think you can see these really look like second order partial derivatives. When you do the u dot u or u transpose u, you're going to get RG, this is a B. You get things like that. Okay, you can guess right away. This is starting to become a little more computationally intensive. Now, you don't have to understand how this works to implement it. But you can sort of see what it's going to is second derivatives, and it's summing up all the x, y's, and z components. What you get out of all of this is you can get just like any derivative, a gradient operator, a direction, you see, this is very important. It's got a direction because, but remember, the gradient is always supposed to be pointing in the direction of greatest change. Well, is it a greater change to go from black to blue, or blue to gray, or even blue to yellow? So this is sort of a pretty reasonable way. I'm probably not going to make you actually try it. So don't panic. And this one, if you have an angle, the direction of the gradient, what else do you need? The magnitude of the gradient. And this one's particularly nasty. And you can see that there's a lot of vectors in here because this looks a little bit like the equation for cosine double angle. Remember, I was earlier telling you that square roots were bad. Look at all of that stuff that I wrote over there. We've got squares, we've got square roots, we've got multiplications. So, if you really want true color edges, which handle the fact that you've got different colors, different saturations, you may have to go to something really fancy. Now, lots of times you don't need that. Okay? But I just wanted to let you know there's a lot out there in the literature on color. And the idea of color edges is still a research problem. It is not solved. Now, this is something a little bit simpler. Why don't we do our processing just like we were doing the segmentation in RGB space? That's pretty much really what everyone does. So we've got a RGB image. We compute a, let's see. This is done, this one, using this method. There was a reason for all of this madness. Okay. This was actually computed by that fancy vector method. This was computed by taking the R, the G, the B image, computing a gradient for each of the colors, and then simply adding the results together. And you can look at it and ask yourself, okay, this had a lot of computation associated with it. People will argue that that's more accurate. You've got this right here, which is done by just implementing gradients. Look at that image. Is this acceptable for your purposes or not? It doesn't look that bad, you know, it catches the edges of the hash, etc. Zoom tight. Okay, notice we've probably picked up much better detail in here. Okay, but you may not be interested in that. This is actually now the subtracted image. So it's the difference between these two. And that's usually a way of comparing algorithms. You just compute the two images and subtract them. Okay, and this edge looks a little fuzzier than that edge, but it has some of the same breaks. The structure seems pretty much the same. You can argue about the width of the lines, etc. But I don't think for the computational difference between those two that doing just a simple gradient in RGB was that bad. And by the way, these are the individual red, green, and blue edge images, gradient images, that were used to calculate this one. So if you take this image and you do a gradient in red, green, and blue, you'll notice these don't look all that different. Notice, though, now, right there. That was not picked up. Red, green, and blue. You know, you don't get any, you don't really get as much of her shoulder in the blue. The blue just doesn't give you as much information. Now, other things. Noise. This is interesting. And we're going to put noise into the red, the green and the blue image. And what this is here is this is color noise. Because if you look closely, it's changed the color. So we have variation in color. Now that might happen with a color camera, maybe a low light one. It might also happen if, you know, maybe these were, well, maybe one of them might be a thermal imager, and you might get a lot of noise in that. But this is what happens when you add it together, very uniform. We're going to look at a couple kinds of noise here. Okay. Now, this is real interesting. This is the HSI image of this image. Okay. And it's, notice, okay, we uniformly added the color, all images. Notice how it appears here. The most striking thing is that the intensity image doesn't look bad. Anyone have an idea why would the intensity image look good? Yes? Excellent. You must have read the book. Oh, you get even more brownie points. But that's exactly right. Because when you go from RGB to intensity, how did you get it? It's one-third R plus G plus D. You just averaged it. What do you do to get rid of Gaussian noise, additive noise? You average it. That's the standard technique. But notice, first of all, U and saturation, it really has messed up our U. And remember, the transformation from RGB space, if you go back, remember those trig functions? It's highly nonlinear. So you can see, it really says that the color is messed up. The saturation isn't so messed up. Saturation would be the amount of white. Okay? The color is. Does that make sense? Going back and looking at that image? Yeah, it didn't add white to it. Or dark. But it does, you know, you look at it in here, it really messes up the color. Different kinds of noise. RGB image, and we put in green noise. Now, this might be a better example of maybe we had an infrared, which might pick up more noise. And salt and pepper would be more typical, I think, of an infrared camera. Maybe not salt and pepper, but at least impulse. Okay, and now look at the H, the S, and the I of it. H, again messed up. Saturation, not too bad. I mean, you can see the noise, and because of that averaging effect, again, intensity doesn't do too badly. Now, you could go in there, and if you knew enough about it, you could actually filter, for example, the green image with a median filter, which you know is good on impulse noise. Now, we're actually getting really near the end of the chapter. This is not something that I would quite call noise. This is what happens when you do image compression. Now, we're more interested in image processing in this course. But for example, for those of you who save your images, for those of you who work with JPEGs, how many people work with RAW? Okay. RAW is an uncompressed image format. By the way, often RAW is double, depending upon your camera, which means instead of 8-bit, it's 16-bit. Photographers, etc., much prefer RAW because it handles dynamic range, and since it's uncompressed, you don't lose information. Now, we haven't talked about compression, Okay. But basically, what happens in compression, most common thing like JPEG, is we do a discrete, a discrete cosine transform. Basically, we simply eliminate the high frequency components. We express it as a finite series, and if you look very closely, you will see basically some slight blurring. You look in here, for example, not quite as sharp. And that's JPEG 2000, which is pretty good. Okay, and there are different compressions out there. And you can get, depending on whose program you use, you can get into lossless compression. That's something else. They probably talk about lossless compression in 454. Anyone in here take 454? Did they do lossless compression, lossy compression? They should have. If not, they should do it in the undergraduate course. Now, if you're really interested, I'd be willing to do compression, but we're going to focus more on stuff applicable to robots. Yes? Those are usually lossless. Now, usually it's an LZW or a derivative, and basically you build up a dictionary of common stuff. In a way, it's sort of like the indexed RGB, probably closer to that. And there are so many patents on that kind of compression, it is not funny. It is unbelievable. Okay. Now, what I'm going to do, if I find my cursor here, this won't move. Uh-oh. I think I have chalk dust on my fingers. That must be the problem. Oh, I closed the wrong one. Ah, okay. I want to show you something now a little bit different. Okay. How do you get from pixels to lines? And if you remember when we had Simon Melikan in here and he was talking about all of the processing of, for example, gradient images, and he ended up finding lines, didn't he? Wasn't that one of the big things? How do you find lines in things? And gee, this might be relevant to your midterm project. Okay. This is actually out of our book. This is interesting. This is just a grayscale image, and their original intent is to find license plates. A horrible thing. Okay. Because it turns out Gonzalez, with a buddy of his, formed a company called Perceptix. I think it must have been 20 years ago. And they had a very innocuous original purpose. This was actually for Canadian and Mexican border crossings, where what they wanted to do was simply automatically record the license plates of vehicles. Okay. Now, this same technology is used by policemen, municipalities, and other evil people all around the world. Okay. Well, maybe they're not evil, but the traffic cameras are. But this one's very simple. If you take that gray image and you run an x-directed gradient, remember, we haven't done these derivatives for a while, have we? And you notice I've been using them more and more today. So we take a derivative in the x direction. Here we take a derivative in the y direction. Now, what we'd really like to do is we'd like to find closed rectangles. Maybe in the future you'd like to find closed triangles or something. But what we've done is we start to combine gradient images and modify them. In this case, what we did was we went to linking, basically independent of the values of the gradients. What we said is this image will be 0 or 1 depending upon A, if the gradients are greater than 25. Says this was just picked for that particular image. So if one of these was greater than 25 and the direction, and I don't mean the x direction and the y direction, I mean the direction of the gradient. Because what we have is, we compute it, gx, we compute it, gy, these are not color, these are just gradients, and we compute it, the magnitude and the direction. We might have done approximations for the magnitude. We've talked about that before. Where we just take the sum of the absolute values. But this has the additional little thing of a direction. So it's got to be strong. And notice what we've done is they've got to be within 15 degrees of each other. If there's a big shift in direction, like maybe at a corner or something, we're not going to include it. In a real outdoor scene, you might have lots of changes in direction due to things like shrubbery, leaves, stuff like that. Natural things may have a lot of detail, but it's usually not oriented. So in finding lines, we've said, okay, we want them. We want this angle to not change, as well as we want the magnitude to be strong. And as a result, we say that has a 1, otherwise it's a 0. And you notice, this turned out not too badly. Notice how well the license plate area and the window area show up, even though this looks like a whole lot of detail here. In effect, it ignored the lettering inside. Okay, really pretty good. That might even be a way to look at a vehicle, follow a vehicle. You know, if you were following a truck, most trucks do have rectangular rears. So depending upon your object, that might be something you want to do. Now, what I want to talk about is something called the Huff transform for a little bit. How many of you in here have heard or used the Huff transform before? Okay, a couple of you. Do you know mathematically how it works? Or did you just use the MATLAB or LabVIEW code? No, meaning you don't know how it works or you didn't use the code.
No, but basically computing the probability of any line in the place.
Okay. Yeah, well, it's not quite. It's not quite. It's a very clever thing. And Professor Huff, or Dr. Huff, I don't know where he was, but he came up with this idea. It was back in the 60s. And unlike most people who published it, he went out and patented it. Then he published it. Although I don't know if it really took over as well as he hoped it would. You know, he hoped he would be the original Google or the original, whatever, Microsoft or whatever. But the whole idea is, this is how we would normally do a line in space. Okay, and usually we would write the equation y equals mx plus b for a line. It's got two parameters, a slope and a y-intercept. Okay? Whole idea is, why don't you flip the equation around? Instead of y equals mx plus b, Okay. Why don't we sort of think of the other situation? Let's change this from X and Y space to how about an M and a B space? Now, that assumes that I'm only interested in lines. So we do the following. Let's suppose we have this point. Is that a 1 or an I? I can't read it on there. It's an I and a J. Okay, so these are I's and these are J's. Okay, so here's the whole idea. Given a point in the image that I think is on a line. If I know X and Y, I can plot this in MX space or in MB space. So I take that one point and I plot the corresponding, let's see, which line is it? I guess it's this one. Okay. So that corresponds to that one. I pick a second point. I do the same thing. I simply invert the equation of the line, and because it's got a different, well, actually, maybe I should draw it out for you. What? Yes. Better? Okay. But you see, this is a line in BM space. Actually, Gonzalez labeled it A and D. Okay, it's the same thing. But you see, I've flipped it around. Given an X and Y in image space, I can draw a line through. Okay, so each point in XY space gives me, and think about these. This is a slope and a y-intercept. What is this line? This line actually is the set of all possible lines going through this point. So it's that line, that line, that line, that line. So that's really what's going on. So these are all the possible lines going through a given point. This is the set of all possible lines going through a different given point. If they are on the same line, that corresponds to a single slope and intercept in Huff space, in transform space. So, in principle, it's not a difficult concept. Now, in practice, it's a little bit more complicated. Okay. You quantize your space to begin with. If you back up, I have to pick a range of y-intercepts and slopes. And by the way, this will immediately lead to a problem, at least for lines. You have slopes that can go to infinity. So we have a problem there. We'll take care of it with a different type of Huff transform very, very shortly. We form an accumulator array. What that is that's just the Huff space. And by the way, did anyone see how sneaky I was in here? Made it ACM? I thought that was pretty bad, but I couldn't resist it. But you form what's called an accumulator array. If you were thinking like in terms of Fourier transforms or something, this would be your transform domain. It is nothing more than you come up with the limits of your axes and you fill all of the values with zero to begin with. Then you pick each point in your original image can you then produce the corresponding lines or whatever over here? So for this point, I actually draw that line, and for each discrete value of this accumulator, I increment it by one. You with me on that? So for this point, every discrete value over here along that line, I increment by one. Over here, the second point, I increment every value by one. And what will happen is now, in this space, everything that's white would be zero. These would have values of one, and this would have a value of two. Now, that's with only two points. The general idea is that in the long run, local maxima in the Huff space tell you where your lines are. And the bigger, and this gets into your probability, the bigger the value is in the Huff space, the more points there are in that line. How long? Now, the key point is that you have to quantize it. You can have positive slopes, you can have negative slopes, you can have positive and negative y-intercepts. That's all this indicates. You know, we don't have fractions of an index. And how big you want to make the index depends on how much resolution you want to have. And when I used to give this assignment in 531, and we took over the department servers, we exhausted all disk space running this in three dimensions. We exhausted everything because we constructed big arrays. Now, it turns out that, and these are on the notes, infinite slope is bad. I can't make a graph going from zero to infinity and have any kind of reasonable scale. This is usually a linear scale. So one of the things is, instead of using y equals mx plus b, use polar coordinates. Okay, r equals x cosine theta plus y sine theta. What that is something exactly like this, a sine wave. It does not have infinite slopes. It goes from zero to a maximum value. That's nice. Okay. And what happens now is instead of each point corresponding to a line in the Huff space, it corresponds to a different sine wave. Just a different sign. The algorithm is otherwise exactly the same. I set up the limits on the Huff axis. I set all of the initial values to zero. For each potential x and y, or rather, for each potential edge point, and I should have made this point clear, we don't go in and Huff transform the whole image. That's too many points. That makes no sense. What we do, and this is the scenario in which you apply it, we compute the gradient, or the Sobel, or something for the entire picture. We threshold it so that there are only a bunch of points. This starts to look very similar to your second assignment. You have only those edge points. And what you want to know is what are the equations of the lines, or which points taken together belong to an edge. And that's what you can analyze the Huff space to get. Because remember, the number at each point tells you how many points are on that line, and the coordinates tell you the slope and y-intercept. Or in this case, technically, it would be the r and the theta. You know, if you do it in polar coordinates, it would be the distance from the origin and the angle of the line. enough to let you reconstruct the line. And this just shows it. I've sort of used R and rho interchangeably, but this is just the polar representation. You don't have to stick to lines. Maybe you are not interested in finding lines in the first place. Maybe you are interested in finding circles. Well, a line was a nice simple thing. It only has two parameters, a slope and a y-intercept. A circle is now a three-space. It's got an A, a B, and an R. The A and the B are the coordinates of the center of the circle. The R is the radius of the circle. I think you can sort of see what's going on now. What's my Huff space look like? It's three-dimensional. A, B, and R. So given an X and a Y, I've got this three-dimensional thing that I'm filling in, this circle. Okay, it's bad if you get too many parameters. You know, someone here wants to try and fit a 10th order polynomial and see if there's any in the image. Well, first of all, I can't figure out why you'd ever do anything like that. But three or four parameters is about all you can go. It's pretty nasty. Now, there are ways to make it nicer. Nicer means faster. Accumulate less points that aren't of interest in the space. This is what might happen if you have a circle. And it turns out, just as we went from points in the XY space, they were lines in the parameter space. Here, what we might want to do is, and we're going to restrict this to a fixed radius. So maybe I only want to find circles of radius 1 in the image. Okay? Well, if there is a point here, and this is the original image space, here's a point. It's potentially on the circumference of a circle. What is the locus of all possible circles going through that point? Well, remember, they're all the constant radius, so the only thing that's of interest is the A and the B, the position. It also is a circle, and that's what you show here. That set of all possible, okay, for that point, are circles. Each one of these corresponds now to all of those circles. Now, the question is, what we did previously was we computed all possible lines, all possible circles. Well, why bother doing that? One of the things is that maybe you could use the direction. Okay? Because this point has a gradient associated with it. And the gradient has both a magnitude and a direction. Really, we were only using the magnitude. We might say, okay, I know that the derivative goes in this direction from a 0 to a 1. I'm only interested in circles up here. I don't have to look, or I don't have to compute the accumulator in all of Huff space. I just compute it in part of Huff space. And you could probably get very carried away. You could make a triangle road lane filter. Technically, this, and I guess it was on the previous slide, technically this is a matched filter. Your look or a pattern recognition device. You are looking for a specific shape. Now, you can get... And this shows you how you could actually do it for an example. No, we're not going to go through it all. But this shows you how you could write your equations given the original X and Y, and you're going to be looking for circles. This is how, and it has all the derivatives in here, this is how you could come up with the Huff transform. And what this does is this is showing, given the gradient direction, I'm only going to compute an arc for each possible circle. So I've probably cut down the computations by 90% by doing that. I've made the individual calculations, and especially my analysis, more difficult. Now this only works for circles. The previous one only worked for lines. You can only work for a given shape. That is the problem of the Huff transform. Maybe. We have the generalized Huff transform. Instead of a closed form equation of a line or a circle or an ellipse or something, we construct a R table. And basically, it's a discrete function. That's all it is. What we do is, for each point on the shape, we will have an angle and a vector to the center of the object. We've identified some center beforehand. So each edge point has a table that tells you the angle and the distance to the center. So basically, we've made a discrete parameterized equation. That's all, and we can do table lookup. Oh, that was a slide I didn't get around to finishing. No problem. And here's an example of a Huff transform. This is one now actually looking for circles. And this was a bad scan of a Xerox, so that's why it looks so crummy. But this is the original image. It's an X-ray. This is the little blown-up image. This now, and this is looking for circles, this is the accumulator array. This is what the Huff space looks like. And it's really hard to tell on here because you can't be really sure. Well, it's not a good grayscale projection, but you can see it looks bright there, and we've got a couple bright spots, and it found all of these little round objects of size that is of radius 3. So if you were looking for circular tumors of a known size, this could look at the X-ray and find all the little round things. If they're square, it will not find them. If it's a different shape, it will not find it. So this is a pretty cool technique. This is, and this is actually just some real data using sine functions, the polar form, okay, that correspond to some real images. And these are the original points, and this is showing the accumulator array. And potentially, this is how you might apply it. This is an infrared image. Okay? And infrared images, this is actually a building and a road. And what you might do is you'd apply maybe Sobel X and Sobel Y, do the magnitude and sum them, something like that, and threshold it. And this is what normally happens. And you saw this when you processed, well, maybe you didn't exactly see it because I don't know if everyone thresholded their results. But you get something like this. And this is actually a well-behaved one. But notice, there's gaps. You're really not sure that this is a line. How about if you want to look for lines in an image? Well, this is what the actual Huff transform of this image looks like. And what you do is you pick the brightest, okay, and then superimpose them back on the original image. This is the complete line. From these coordinates, you have the equation of the line. That's the important thing. So you've got these three, and actually, they're smaller. You might have set your threshold. In this, you don't want to pick up houses. You only want stuff going the whole way across. So you actually threshold this. And there, you've picked up the complete lines. You have an equation of the line. You can throw away your original data and process the equation of the line. What you've done here might be called data compression. What a number of people in early vision would say is this is artificial intelligence. I've taken all of this original unstructured and I've come up with a mathematical description of it. A good guy in artificial intelligence said that artificial intelligence is nothing more than data compression. You can think about that statement. It's not a bad one. Now, all of that dealt with lines. How about some areas? How about segmentation? And how about, boy, we're close to running out of time. We have 1 minute here. Okay, this is a really easy one. What you'd like to do when confronted with an image like this is you might like to know, okay, you might want to create a data structure. And you might want to say, okay, I've got object one, and here is a list of all of the pixels that is all of the XY coordinates corresponding to pixels which are inside this object. And you can also compute then other feature attributes once you have that. You can compute an average. You can compute bounding rectangles. You can compute perimeters. You can do all kinds of things, but you can't do that until you know you can't do anything until you know what pixels belong to the object. That's what segmentation is all about. Whoa. Which ones belong? And the most common way, and you'd probably do it on this, it's pretty simple, black is background, anything above a certain value is the object. You use gray level. You can also use color to segment, like we were doing today. And what's the first thing you would do? You'd look at the histograms. This is a very easy one to work with. There's two objects, background and object. Actually, I should have said there's only one object and background. This one looks like it may have two objects and background. So you can learn a lot by looking at your histogram. And if you read papers on color segmentation, what they actually start doing is they start looking at the histograms of the color distributions. And that might tell you asphalt, grass, blue sky. Okay, so you may be doing a lot of that in color space. And on that point, we'll pick up. Notice we're back in Gonzales. I'm temporarily in Chapter 10. And the only reason I'm doing the Chapter 10 right now is to give you more background for your midterm project. Okay? And notice, there won't be a homework this week. I'll be writing up and giving you a description of your midterm project. I probably won't give you a homework for 2 or 3 weeks because your projects will be due. So I expect dynamite projects. I expect code that I can download into Dexter and drive by. What?
Then it must be written in LabVIEW.
Well, the algorithm. We'll rely upon people to translate it. But we will want an extremely robust, reliable algorithm, and the winner gets to stand alongside the road. Or maybe the loser. And we start Dexter.